American professor Pamela Ronald has a foot on each side of the genetically modified food debate. She works with GM foods in the lab, GM crops, and she is married to an organic farmer. Whether organics can accommodate any GM components at all is a debate raging in the United States and here. Professor Ronald is professor of plant pathology at the University of California, Davis, where she studies the role that genes play in a plant's response to its environment. She and her husband, Raul Adamczyk, wrote a book a few years ago on organic farming, genetics, and the future of food. It's called Tomorrow's Table. She says that environmentalists should love GM crops because they make farming more sustainable. I asked her how she is so sure that genetically engineered food is safe.
We know that the process of genetic engineering has the similar sorts of risks as the process of conventional breeding. So any time you develop a new plant variety, whether it's with genetic engineering or any other type of genetic technique, you're creating a new combination of genes. And there's some risks of unintended consequences. But with genetic engineering, so far, the crops that are on the market, there has not been any adverse harm to human health or the environment.
I suppose the opponents of it are worried that in the end nobody will have any choice. I mean, the point's been made that in the United States, most of the corn grown there is genetically modified. Because corn cross-pollinates so easily, then even organic foods have at least some GM component. And people take offense at that. Do you agree?
I think people really need to keep in mind what's important, that we really want to have an ecologically based farming system as much as possible to reduce amounts of insecticides, to enhance genetic diversity, to foster successful farmers. These are really the key questions. And I'm sure New Zealanders feel the same way as many of us do, that we really have a duty and a moral imperative to feed the poor and malnourished.
So that's Mormon apple pie. But when people think about Monsanto, they don't think about Monsanto trying to improve the world. They think about Monsanto trying to make as much profit as possible and try to prevent farmers from reusing their own seeds.
Yeah, I think it's really important to distinguish between corporations and the technology.
So
the
is it easy to do that, however?
Oh, absolutely. All plant biologists all over the world are using genetic engineering. High school students are using genetic engineering. Nonprofit groups are using genetic engineering. And I think it's important for New Zealanders, if they do not want to buy American corporate seed, that they simply do not, right? So they need to foster their own breeding programs, whether that may include genetic engineering or it may not. And they need to foster programs that really achieve the goals of sustainable agriculture.
See, it's interesting that your position is, as somebody with a foot in both camps, as it were, the camps being anti-GM and organic agriculture. Your husband is an organic farmer. He sees no problem with genetically modified crops because they can help with, as you said before, the sustainability of it all. But why is there such opposition to it, do you think?
I think, well, so we try to avoid the acrimonious debate in our book. We really try to stay on top of the issues that really matter, I think.
But there is an acrimonious debate. Why are people so opposed to it?
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right that there's association of the technology with corporations. And certainly there's large corporations that have jumped on this technology and that are using it. There's no question about that. But there's also many, many groups around the world using this technology. And in fact, in just a few years, by 2015, most of the genetically engineered crops on the market will be released from national programs and not from large American corporations. And so I think that could provide some assurance to your listeners that are opposing the technology because they don't like corporations.
It might be useful at this point to look at what you've been doing with rice.
Sure. My favorite subject.
I mean, that's most of your career, right?
Yes.
Working on how to make a better rice crop. What's the matter with the one we've got?
So I work on rice for about the last 25 years I've been working on rice. So rice is the world's most important staple. It feeds about half, it's a staple for about half the world's population. And so early on as a graduate student, I was very interested in working on rice because even small changes to the resistance to disease or tolerance to environmental stresses can have a very large impact on many very poor farmers. And so I can give you an example of why people continue to do breeding and genetic alteration. And so in rice grows in water. We think of it as growing in water. But if it's completely submerged for 3 days, the rice plant will die. And virtually all varieties will die if completely submerged. And this is a tremendous problem in South and Southeast Asia because it's estimated that something like 4 million tons of rice that's sufficient to feed 30 million people is lost every year to flooding, and that's just in two countries, India and Bangladesh. So, very interestingly, about 50 years ago, a rice breeder found a very unusual variety that could stay underwater for 2 weeks. It's almost like it could hold its breath until the flood was gone and then start growing again.
Found it.
Yes. So there's a lot of different rice varieties, and scientists are always fiddling around with them and trying to test their properties.
But this one was out there naturally growing somewhere, was it?
Yeah. And
it wasn't found in the lab.
No. Well, there are seed collections, and there's a lot of rice that's not grown any longer, but there's seed collections. You know, 80,000 seeds, people grow them. But so the idea is to try to bring the trait into modern varieties. So this old variety doesn't taste well, it doesn't yield well, no farmer grows it anymore, if they ever did. So by conventional breeding, they tried to introduce this trait into modern varieties that are locally adapted to environments in India and Bangladesh, for example.
So that they too could hold their breath for
exactly.
Rice.
So they can maintain the same characteristics of yield, flavor, quality, and still survive the flood. But conventional breeding failed to be able to move that trait in. And the reason is that conventional breeding, you don't really know what you're dealing with. You make crosses and you mix large sets of uncharacterized genes. And so you often bring in genes you don't want as well as the gene that you do want.
In other words, it's too clumsy a fit.
Yes.
Right.
So a number of years ago, a collaborator of mine, Dave McKill, who is at UC Davis, he's now at the International Rice Research Institute, began a project together to see if we could isolate the gene in that flood-tolerant variety. And we were...
Isolate the gene for flood tolerance.
Yes.
How do you go about finding that?
So you do a lot of genetic experiments. You plant it out and you make big, we call them... This might get too technical. We make large libraries. We take big chunks of the genome and we isolate them. We put them in bacteria. We sequence them. We read the sequence. And there was one gene that we found that was associated with the flood tolerance trait. And we were very excited about it because when the plant was submerged, it was rapidly activated. We consider it turned on. And
so that's how you identified it.
And well, no, the way to for sure. So that gives you a clue. But to identify it, what we did in my laboratory is we genetically engineered it into a rice variety that normally dies in the flood. And by adding a single gene, the plant could stay underwater for 2 weeks. So we knew we had the right gene. Then my collaborator in the Philippines used marker-assisted breeding, which is a precision breeding approach, using the genetic information to introduce the gene into varieties favored by farmers in Bangladesh and India and Indonesia and the Philippines. And what they're finding is that the new variety has the exact same qualities as the variety older varieties, except for one thing. It can stay underwater for 2 weeks, and the yields are 4 to 5-fold under flooded conditions. Those varieties have now been released through the International Rice Research Institute and I think are starting to make quite a big impact for very poor farmers. So these farmers live on less than a dollar a day.
Can they acquire these seeds, the rice seeds, and plant them one season and then replant them?
Yes.
I mean, they don't have to keep buying new ones. That's always been the problem with the corporate control of GM seed, hasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, people, I think, get a little confused. They think genetic engineering means you can't self your seed, but you can. If you put a gene in, no matter how you put the gene in, it doesn't matter whether it's conventional breeding or genetic engineering, you can self the seed. And
the, you can what the seed?
Well, we call it self the seed, self-pollinate the seed. So the farmer grows up the plant, they collect the seed produced from the plant, and they replant it. And rice, in many of these poor countries, that's how most rice is produced. So yes, the farmer can collect their own seed. There's no corporate ties to the seed. And sometimes people confuse hybridization with genetic engineering. So hybrids, farmers always go back and buy the seed. And there's genetic reasons for that. But organic farmers buy hybrids, conventional farmers buy hybrids. In the developed world, many farmers buy hybrids. But in the less developed world, there's less use of hybrids. And the seed that we developed is not a hybrid, and the farmer can just grow it.
So the seed that you invented is now growing throughout the rice-eating world?
Yeah, four countries. And so the International Rice Research Institute is making big efforts to help farmers grow more seed, produce more seed. So there's you know, in a sense, a shortage of seed. It takes several generations to get enough seed to distribute widely.
But, and there are no prohibitions on GM seed in any of these countries?
So this seed was developed, the one that was released. So we used genetic engineering in the lab, but the one that was released was used as another technique called precision breeding. So there's many different genetic techniques, but precision breeding, there's no restrictions on precision breeding.
What's the difference? What's the difference between GM and precision bred?
Well, actually, genetic engineering introduces one gene.
Yeah.
But it uses a technique called genetic engineering that goes through a laboratory step. And for some reason, and we can talk about what those reasons might be, that particular process was tagged as being something that the organic community didn't want. Whereas this other approach, precision breeding, which actually introduces more genes at a time, is acceptable. Even though it's the same gene, it's a different process.
Why?
Yeah, well, scientifically, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But there is, as you have just brought up, there's this consumer perception that there's something.
But this sounds like some kind of PR doublespeak to get around the opposition to GM.
Well, you know, I know, it's crazy. So for a long time, many of the people against genetic engineering were also against precision breeding. But then there was sort of a shift. And, okay, well, maybe precision breeding's okay.
I'm still confused.
Oh, I know.
All right. What is the difference between GM and precision breeding?
Okay, so everything's genetically modified that we eat. Virtually everything on your plate every day has been altered using genetics.
Well,
but there's different
types. Not in
the
laboratory, though.
No, even in the laboratory, even in the laboratory. So scientists use, breeders have used mutagenesis for, you know, 40 years to randomly create mutations in the laboratory and select out those mutations and use them for breeding lines. And that can be certified organic. It's just genetic engineering. So the issue with genetic engineering, and I think this is the main reason people... the main difference between genetic engineering and other approaches is that with genetic engineering, if you wanted, you could introduce a bacterial gene into a plant species.
Yes.
That is perhaps the critical difference that has created this fervor.
That's right.
Fervor.
Interspecies engineering rather than intraspecies engineering.
Right. But currently, right now, even if it's a rice gene in a rice plant, if it's used through genetic engineering, it's not accepted in the certified organic label.
Hmm. Your husband.
Yeah, it's very technical.
It is. Well, it's technical, and it's also. It's. I know. I have to go back to it again.
Yeah.
Give me an example of what's acceptable to be labeled organic in the States in terms of genetically modified, and what isn't.
So all farmers use seed that has been genetically altered. They use hybrid seed, they use triploid seed, they use mutagenized seed, they use grafted seed, they use all those techniques are acceptable except genetic engineering. It's the only
technique. And what's your definition of genetic engineering?
Genetic engineering is taking an isolated gene and introducing it into the plant.
Which is
directly,
what you did with the rice.
Which is what we did with the rice in the laboratory. Precision breeding uses a pollination step.
So it, in a way, naturalizes what was once unnatural. Is that what you're saying?
Well, natural...
Give me an insight. Yeah, you're married to an organic farmer, right?
Okay.
Give me an insight into why one thing is okay and the other is not. What does he say?
Okay, so this is really the crux of the issue. I think that this focus on the method of introducing the gene is not useful for the environment or for food safety or for the society. We really need to look at the outcome. Can we produce fourfold yield for very poor farmers? Can we reduce the use of insecticides? Can we shift to less toxic herbicides? Can we foster soil fertility? Really, those are the key questions. And that's what we try to do in the book. We actually try to get away from this debate on the technique used to introduce a gene and instead focus on the outcome. What do we want to achieve? What does New Zealand want to achieve with their agriculture? Those are the big, important questions.
Let me go to another example. I think you've suggested that bananas, right? Bananas have fallen prey to a bacterial blight that seems to be wiping out the banana that we have become accustomed to buying and eating. And genetic engineering could help immunize bananas against this blight. Is this not buying into a monoculture of agriculture model and saying, okay, well, we've blanketed the world with this type of banana, and this type of banana has now got a disease, so we're going to change the banana and blanket the world with another kind of banana. The idea that genetic engineering or genetically modified food is encouraging that kind of monoculture form of agriculture is a strong suspicion that people have.
Yeah, they do have that suspicion, and certainly we know for many, many years that when you plant crops in monocultures, they are more susceptible to disease outbreaks. That's something we've known for 50 years, 100 years, well, maybe 50 years. So there's no question we need to introduce diversity into our farms. But the issue is that genetic engineering creates a variety like any other variety. So right now you can plant a non-genetically engineered variety in a monoculture, or a genetically engineered variety in a monoculture. It's the farming practice there that becomes important. And that's
But the point is that monocultures are bad, right? Your husband would say this, you would say this. Monocultures...
No, you can't say... So that's what's so complex about agriculture. So what we try to do in the book is we talk about the farming practices are equally important as to the seed that's used. So in some situations, a monoculture might be useful because you're feeding a lot of people. So it's a balance between having an efficient farming system and having vulnerability to disease. And so what we try to do in the book is talk about the importance of incorporating genetic diversity into the farming system. And you may do that with conventionally grown seed. You may do it with genetically engineered seed. You might do it with an approach, with a combination. So let me give you a concrete example. I think that will help. So in Hawaii, these are fairly small farms, papaya farms. So in the 1950s, a virus came and devastated the entire papaya production on the island of Oahu. So there was no way to control this disease. There was no organic method. There was no conventional method. There was nothing you could spray. There was nothing the farmers could do. So they moved to another island that did not have this disease. But it was predicted that the virus would move because, of course, plants get viral diseases as humans do. The virus moves around. And indeed, in the 1990s, the virus had moved to this new area plantation. It started devastating, again, knocking out the entire papaya industry. So there was a local Hawaiian with a small grant, nonprofit grant, developed a papaya that was genetically engineered to resist the disease. And he used an approach, it's similar, conceptually similar to human vaccination. So vaccinated against smallpox or polio. It's mechanistically different, but you can imagine you take just a snippet and it immunizes the plant. So today, 90% of the papaya that we get in Hawaii is all genetically engineered. And it's been successful now for about 15 years. And there's still no other way to grow that papaya in Hawaii. All the other varieties and all the other farming methods have become susceptible.
So what happens when the diseases get ahead of the genetic engineering? In other words, they're pretty mutable viruses, and eventually they will get through the defense system that has been incorporated into that particular papaya. So then you'll have to go back to the lab, will you?
Well, you know, that's a excellent question, because, of course, that's why I have a job. I'm a plant pathologist.
Right.
And so we've had plant pathologists for over 100 years because we know that diseases progress. And you might find a resistant variety that will work well for several years, but it may succumb to a particular disease later on. So there's no question that there's no magic bullet. And that's why we need all types of tools and people working on these problems. The papaya is actually quite a fantastic example, because 15 years of durability for resistance is remarkable, actually. It's not to say that it'll last forever. And certainly breeders and scientists are looking at other methods. And we're always looking at other varieties to see if there's some resistance. So we know as scientists that the most economic and effective way to control disease is to use a resistant variety. That's because the resistance is embedded in the seed. The farmer plants the seed. Boom, no spraying, no toxic inputs, it's very cheap and very effective. But we also know that resistance can break down. And so that's the way, that's essentially the way farming works. So virtually every food you eat has a resistance gene in it, because we've been breeding for resistance ever since the genetic basis of resistance was discovered about 100 years ago.
It's the idea that a gene or a piece of DNA be taken from, you know, a jellyfish and be put into a tomato that unnerves people. You understand that, don't you?
Yeah, I can see that. But then if you drill down a little bit, you think, okay, so organic farmers spray some dried up dead bacteria that contains a toxin called BT. And they spray this gamish on their plants, and it's very effective for insects that feed on the outside of the plants. So what geneticists have done has taken the single gene, now it's only making one protein, and putting it inside the plant. And so now you have cotton that's tolerant and resistant of these insects. So it's using an organic pesticide, except it's engineered into the cotton. And so then you think, okay, well, we don't eat cotton. Maybe that's okay. It's an organic compound. Well, maybe that's okay. Well, you know, maybe I still don't like it. But then if you look a little deeper and you take it, and I really encourage people to be specific, because you can't talk about genetic engineering unless you're specific. So you take a look at cotton farmers in Arizona, and the farmers growing genetically engineered cotton that are engineered with this gene called BT are using half the insecticide, and they're getting the same yield as their neighbor that's growing conventional cotton. And the farmers growing genetically engineered cotton are seeing twice the biological diversity in their field. And that's easy to understand, because they're using less insecticide. So if the goal is to reduce insecticide and to increase the profit for the farmers, you know, you're going to be pretty happy with that particular product. And if you're opposed to buying seeds from corporation under any circumstances, you wouldn't like it, because this is a Monsanto product. So I think you really have to ask the right questions in order to get at the answers. To say all GMOs are bad doesn't help. That's my position. And in a papaya, there's no Monsanto involved. So maybe somebody else would. So a papaya farmer would say, you know, I really like that, because I would not be making a living if it wasn't for this genetically engineered papaya that was distributed for free.
What about your flash submersible rice? Did Monsanto buy that from you? If
now
not,
that,
why not?
So first of all, I'm not funded by Monsanto or any large corporations.
But that doesn't stop you.
No, I know.
Selling a good product.
Oh, definitely. I'm not opposed to people doing that. So I have worked. This project was a 10-year project, And it was funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for, you know, 10 years. It's going quite a long time. So it's nonprofit funded, and it's a gene that benefits very, very poor farmers. And so Monsanto does not have an interest in, at least at the time, in this kind of product. And that's something people don't understand either. There's a lot of food that we eat that many people in the less developed world are eating, but we're not eating. And so unless there's a profit motive, the companies aren't interested. So we really need to support public sector research to benefit farmers in those countries.
I'm talking to geneticist Professor Pamela Ronald. Can you see any sign of the standoff, which is alive and well in many quarters, between genetic engineering and organic ending?
No, I don't think so. I think what's going to happen, I think there's a lot of consumers that really like the organic label and they want to buy organic. So my husband was president of California Certified Organic Farmers when the label went from local California to national. And at the time, the USDA said, okay, we're going to accept genetically engineered crops because, you know, it's clean, it's green, and it fits perfectly. Well, the consumers didn't think so, and the activists didn't think so. The USDA received 250,000 letters saying, no, we don't want genetic engineering in that label. So that's why the organic label does not allow genetically engineered crops. And I don't think that's going to change. So
even though the fact is that most corn in the United States is GE, and so even organic produce that uses corn is going to have a GE component.
No, that's not true. So there is organic corn. My husband grows organic corn. The problem with it, of course, is that at the end of the season...
Cross-pollinates, right?
No. Well, where we are, there's no cross-pollination at all with genetically engineered corn. The problem with organic corn is you always get worms at the end of the season because they're susceptible and there's no way to control these worms. But, you know, we don't care. We chop the worm off, you know, we throw it away. So I think really what we're getting at here, I don't think it's worth efforts to change the organic label. Why change the label? People are happy. I think we need to target the other 98% of agriculture that is open to genetic engineering and move that to sustainability as much as we can. And I think it's that's what's happening. That is what's happening. You're seeing there's a record reduction in the amount of insecticides in the U.S. because of genetically engineered
corn and
cotton.
There is a danger to everything, right? In the last green revolution, everybody went, you know, wahoo. We've got fossil fuels that we can turn into fertilizer, and we've got, you know, irrigation, and we can improve the production of the entire globe. Now we discover that we have polluted water and we're running out of fossil fuels, and putting a whole lot of stuff on everything is not a good idea. So, wahoo, we've got genetically engineered food now, which is going to solve a lot of those problems you say. Can you imagine that there is a downside to this as well? If so, what is it?
Okay, so just to clarify, I don't think genetic engineering is going to solve all those problems. I think it's another tool in a future ecological system. And we need to incorporate practices such as crop rotation and genetic diversity together with the best science. And sometimes that's a genetically engineered seed. Sometimes it's a precision bred seed. Sometimes it's another seed. So we really need to take the best tools and tackle that particular situation.
The world isn't like that, is it?
It is.
The world, because of the way it is dominated by, I mean, I'm not paranoid here, but it is dominated by big business. If somebody says, this is better than that in the circumstance, then the big business says, this is going to be better than that in too many circumstances, and we're going to get out of balance again, just as we got out of balance with pesticides and fertilizer.
You know, I understand that you can't predict the future, but I think there's a danger in being too all-encompassing, too black and white. I don't think any farmer would say, this is all good or this is all bad. They look at that particular situation, what tools are available for that situation. And the process of genetic engineering, it's very clear that the process has risk, but it's also very clear that the process itself has no difference in the amount of risk compared to conventional breeding, right? So that has been virtually all the academic societies that have looked at this, the Royal Society, the National Academy of Sciences, the societies in India, Mexico, they all have reported that the crops on the market are safe to eat. That doesn't mean that the next new variety that comes out that's genetically engineered or the next new variety that comes out through conventional breeding is going to be safe to eat. Everything has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
All right.
And I think that's what's so difficult for consumers.
Why wouldn't it be safe to eat?
Okay, well, let me give you an example. So the kiwi is a good example. When we first brought the kiwi to the United States...
Kiwi fruit, yeah.
The kiwi fruit.
Okay.
There was a number of people that developed allergies. That was an unintended consequence. It wasn't predictable. And still, there are people that are allergic to kiwis. So it's a new variety. And there's other examples. So there's a celery that was developed just through conventional breeding. It was really great. The farmers liked it. It was resistant to many insects. It was released. And farm workers, when they were harvesting the celery, they started to develop a rash on their hand. You know, these are what people consider unpredicted consequences. But for whatever reason, and we can talk about what those reasons might be, the genetically engineered crops that have been commercialized have not caused a single instance of harm to human health or the environment.
Are there reasons for that? What are you saying?
Well, people argue about the reasons for that. So one reason is that genetically engineered crops are regulated. So a breeder can release a new kiwi variety, a new celery variety, and it doesn't go through any safety tests at all. Okay? And genetically engineered crops are highly regulated, so there's a much higher bar to get those crops out there on the market. So some people will say, well, that's obviously the reason. They're safer because they're more highly regulated. You know, you can quibble with that if you want. You know, I'm not sure that's the reason. Other people will say that, well, there's not that many genetically engineered traits on the market. There's many crops, but often the bulk are two traits, insect resistance and herbicide tolerance, and then there's the papaya I mentioned. There's not that many out there. So other people will say, well, you know, there's just not that many out there yet. That's why there's been so many more examples of harm from conventional crops. So, but I think the point is that the risks are similar. And you have to look at the benefits. What are the benefits? And I think when 300,000 people every year are dying from insecticide poisoning, there's a good reason to reduce the amount of insecticides in the environment. I'm not saying that all insecticides are toxic, but some are. And cotton uses 25% of the world's insecticides, cotton alone. So if we can reduce the amount of insecticides in cotton, which we have already, not me, but other groups, that's actually a huge step forward.
What about the fear that a genetically engineered crop is going to cross-pollinate with another perfectly ordinary crop and breed some kind of monstrosity that we'll never get rid of? I mean, that's the visceral fear, isn't it, of genetic engineering?
Yeah, people worry about that. And certainly crops will cross-pollinate. And we know that because we've had cross-pollination ever since we've had agriculture.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the line you see that doesn't make sense to me. We've always done this. We've always bred
this.
Well,
I didn't finish.
Okay. Now we have a whole new thing. We have essentially a plant that has never existed naturally. Never. And it might cross-pollinate with something else to give a whole entirely new thing.
Okay, so I didn't finish. So I understand what you're saying. You don't want to... it is different. I'm not saying that genetically engineered crops are exactly the same as the other crop. They are different. But what I was trying to say is that we know a lot about pollen flow. And one thing we know is that weeds taking over the environment, I'm not really sure what weeds you have here, but we have horrible weeds in the United States. Horrible.
A weed is just a plant in the wrong place.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we used to have these beautiful perennial grasslands all over Central California, and now they're covered with introduced European grasses.
Yeah.
With star thistle, which is horrible. It's toxic to the animals, and it gets all over the place. Our waterways are clogged with these big, bushy plants. So there is no question that weeds can devastate an ecosystem. But it's important to realize that these weeds are not single gene changes. These weeds are introduced, they're exotics from other countries. And that's where you have these enormous weed problems. And in fact, if you look at domesticated crops, okay, you never see a corn plant growing in the native ecosystems around the Central Valley where I live. The reason is that it needs the farmer to take care of it. These plants that we eat are so bizarre, they would never exist in it. I shouldn't say never, never say never, that they would have a difficulty thriving in a native ecosystem. They need water. They have these huge fruits that stay on the plant and they have to be picked off, which is what we want, right? And so they're very different. They don't have these sort of weedy characteristics. And as far as I know, it's perhaps no example of a domesticated crop gone wild. It's really the exotics that come in. So I love the pampas grass around here.
Toy.
Yeah, or cutty grass.
Ah, yes.
Cutty grass. It grows all around where I live, California. But in California, it's a nasty weed because it just takes over. It can't stay in check and it grows past the native ecosystem. So, you know, your native plants are our weeds. So that's a different issue than a single gene in a plant. So as we know, we've been introducing single genes into our domesticated crops for 100 years, and they've been introduced through a different process, but we know how they've behaved. So there is a history. So the weed issue that you hear about, I think there's less a concern of sort of creating monster plants that take over the ecosystem. The concern really is weeds in the farm system. That's what people are concerned about. And we could talk about that too, if you want. But
well,
we've been talking a lot about insect-tolerant crops using BT, which is this organic pesticide that's been engineered to the crop. It's reduced insecticide use. The other major genetically engineered crop is herbicide tolerance. Herbicide-tolerant crops, they do not benefit organic farmers because organic farmers can't use herbicides. They're not so useful in the less developed world because those people often cannot afford the herbicides, but they have some benefits in, for example, the United States. And the main benefit is it's a shift from a highly toxic herbicide to a much more benign herbicide.
Roundup.
Right. So Roundup is much...
And people are very suspicious of this, of course, because, it's just Monsanto's way of selling more Roundup.
Yeah. And of course, it's great for them. But the issue that's come up is that we know if you spray only one herbicide over and over and over, the weeds will become resistant. And then the farmer can no longer use that herbicide if they have a lot of resistant weeds. So that's when people talk about weeds, generally what they're talking about that particular farming system, not the surrounding ecosystem. And again, it's not a problem for organic farmers because they don't use the herbicide. So again, you have to be very specific about what you're talking about. And that's really what we encourage people to do in our book. Let's talk about the specific farming system and the specific goal we're trying to achieve.
Mm. But at the end of it all, people are worried that they will be left with no choice. People still want, yes, it's anti-GM or anti-GE, but it's also about insisting on having a choice. And the fear is that suddenly everything is going to be acceptable, taken for granted, and pushed by, yes, the corporates, and nobody's going to have a choice anymore. Isn't that what it's about?
Yeah, well, I mean, we all want to have choices, and I think that it is important. That's why I think the organic label is good. The choice there is people can plant organic. They can buy organic produce. It's not genetically engineered, right? So I think in the United States, really what we more worry about, maybe you worry about here, I'm concerned about just a few groups controlling a lot of the seed. And I think that's a problem if you have a monopoly in the seed industry. But that's an issue of the Department of Justice. It's not a technology issue, if you know what I mean. So I think these are really important questions. But again, it's not something that the technology can influence.
Is there anything that you and your organic farming husband disagree on?
Oh, we agree.
In this area.
Everything. Every day we agree. You know, we're very supportive of each other's work. So
yes, right. I'm sure there's a marriage made in heaven, blah, blah, blah. But is there anything that you actually disagree on in terms of genetic modification, genetic engineering, where it's going, how it's done?
You know, when we wrote the book, we were going to write the book as kind of a, you know, let's have an antagonistic and we'll have little arguments in the book. And any time we looked into the issue, I hate to say, we did come to agreement. And the reason is our goal is the same, an ecologically based farming system. And when you start looking into a particular issue, you and I think your listeners also will agree on the general criteria for an ecologically based system, right? It should feed the poor malnourished. It should be safe to eat. It should foster soil fertility. It should reduce insecticides. It should reduce energy use, minimize land use, minimize water use. These are sort of principles that most people can agree on. So then how do you get there? So Raul, in his farming, he doesn't use genetically engineered seed because he's an organic farmer. He's not allowed to, but he has some problems that he cannot control. There's this little bug called Symphylon that's in the ground, and you can't grow anything in that area because it kills everything you plant there. So conventional growers will use methyl bromide, but that's a highly toxic chemical. So there's no good solution. So I think, for example, he would like to see a genetically engineered seed that could tolerate this particular problem, but it doesn't exist right now. So it's not even, there's no reason for him to try to shift away from that.
Pamela Ronald, a huge quantity of emails in response to Pamela Ronald. Actually, some in response to Pamela Ronald, some even before Pamela Ronald uttered a word.